And no snub intended to you, but I had some questions for Will first,
oh, please,
if that's all right. Yeah, all right. Maybe we'll put him on the spot.
There you go.
Yeah. what I'd like to do, well, it's pretty simple, is just talk to you about your experience. So there's no, it's not a quiz, no right or wrong answers. I thought we could just sort of move chronologically, and I'll ask questions I might ask you to go.
I didn't have many experiences.
Well, maybe could you tell me when you joined? I guess the firm was National Technical Labs at that time.
National Tech, yeah. I joined March 31st, 1938. And so you interested in what I was doing?
Before that, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what you were doing before you.
Before that?
Yeah.
Gosh, I worked for a small company up in Pasadena building police transmitters. And that went on for a while, but finally I got laid off because of lack of work there. And a few months later, the boss of the place called me and he says, go out to 3330 East Colorado Street and see a mason. So yeah, I had imagined I'm going to be building walls, masonry walls. Anyway, I went out there and they needed somebody to lace cables.
Hmm.
And so, okay, I took the job of lacing cables, which I did for quite a while. I got pretty good at it. And Dr. Beckman used to bring people around, some of the people from Caltech, they used to come down there and they'd stand around and watch me lace cables. Now that was kind of exciting. It used to really make me nervous. Anyway, and I went into sort of wiring the instruments, making resistors, and I did the layout for new cables for new instruments as they came up, cable boards, and I got into it pretty good there, so, and got into some of the testing of it. So, gee, what else? Gosh, I did do some of the design work on the laying out of the instruments. And, of course, we started to make the HeliPot back in 39?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess about 39 when I started to make the HeliPot. And I know that the fellow wound the cores on a lathe, and I helped put them together in the little containers. So that was pretty good experience there.
Maybe we could go back to if you could say some more about what National Technical Laboratories was like when you joined it in 1938, the facility, how many people were working
there? Well, okay, there were about 15 of us, I guess, when I started. And it was just it's a little building, flat roof, and it was, of course, in the summertime, it got pretty darn warm. And not super big, but it had front area for the offices, and then we come back to the machine shop, and had the glass shop, of course, in there. And the back end of it was the assembly area that I worked in, and behind that was shipping. So it was, the whole thing wasn't really too big. But I know that the glass shop was probably one of the little bigger section of the group. Remember, Dr. Baxter was, I think, the head of the glass shop. And Johnny Simpson ran that. Who else? Let me think. Gosh, I can't remember the other fellow's name there. One other fellow that worked there with Johnny Simpson in the glass shop. Of course, they blew all the electrodes. made standard cells.
Mm-hmm.
They made all the standard cell for the Model G. And don't think they weren't making hydrogen lamps at that time because we hadn't made the spectra yet. But, well, they were making something else in there, but I can't recall now.
And who were some of the other employees at that time?
Well, in the office was, oh boy, you're stretching my memory. Can't remember the girl's name. They had an office girl. I can't remember her name. And Claire Mason. Claire Mason was the one that hired me. He was a production manager, or plant manager, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Claire died last year.
Mm.
And then, who the heck was Jimmy Salzer? No, Jimmy Salzer was the accountant, payroll man, everything. He did all the money stuff on it. And of course, Dr. Beckman. I guess when I started there, Dr. Beckman was a vice president.
Right.
He wasn't even president at the time.
Who was?
Beckman.
Who was president?
What was his name? Golly, I don't know. Green? Green, that doesn't sound right. Can't remember who he was.
Oh, my.
No,
it's just that my memory's not all that good. But anyway, Dr. Beckman finally quit. He was teaching, of course, down at Caltech at the time. So he quit there, and then he took over full-time there as president of the company. And we still, at that time, we were making the inks for the inking company.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fellow there, Arnold. Oh, boy, what was his name? I can't remember his last name.
I said Arnold. Mm-hmm.
No. But anyway, he made the ink. Remember that?
Those were in small batches.
Yeah. Yeah, because we were a pretty small company
right
at the time. And I do remember him making the ink. And, and of course, then there was Russell Vanneman. Russell Vanneman was kind of in a wood shop. And Russell Vanneman, you know, he's the one that went in with Howard Carey there as far as making the applied physics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they went together and started that. But then, of course, Howard Carey was the chief engineer. I had a fellow in engineering by the name of Test, but I don't remember his name.
No.
He went by, that's what he went by, it was Test. It's the only name I ever heard from him. And what else? Who else was there? Frank Traphagen ran the machine shop. He was the only machinist. Ran, did everything. Let's see, and Frank Traphagen, Frank Camarda, the other ones, oh shoot, one that kind of helped me, I can't remember his name. I'll think of Carter. Oh, hey, yeah.
Will that help?
It might. Yes, Johnny Simpson. Charlie Donaldson. Thank you. Yeah, Charlie Donaldson. He's the one that was there doing the cable lacing before I started. He taught me how to do it. And, let's see. And my boss was, boy, yeah, shoot, stretching my brain too much.
Well, in addition to production of the ink and production of the pH meters, was NTL doing any contract research, one-off research projects, do you know?
No,
yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think it was all just for, well, see, when I started, we were making the Model G pH meter and the Model M pH meter. And then, a little later on, they came up with the Model R pH meter, which was an industrial pH meter. And I did all the layout work on the cabling and the wiring and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty much all of it in, over there in Pasadena.
What pH meter was it that you used to build the micro amp meter?
It was, we used the Model R and redid that one. But that was later on. Now that's when we moved to South Pasadena. In 1940. Don't remember the month, do you? Were you there?
I was more than a twinkle in 1940, but...
So that's pretty much the instruments we made. Of course, we did make some other special ones for, like, a Sugar Model G, a Sugar G, they called it. For, I guess it was just strictly for the sugar industry. I'm not too sure just why they needed that in place of a standard Model G, but it, a little more precise instrument than the other one. So I think that was all the instruments that we did over there in Pasadena.
And could you tell, say a little bit more about the making the helipod, the potentiometer, the story of that?
Okay. Well, okay, I think my own idea is that Howard Carey is the one who really did all the work on it.
I'm sorry, let me just move this over a little bit closer to the screen.
All right.
Why, well, not because of the secret noise being loud in here. I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing. I'm sorry. You were saying, okay.
Do you want to sit opposite him?
No, that's it. This is great. No, stay where you are.
Yeah, he... I'm not too sure just how much Dr. Beckman played in the part of that. He probably came up with the idea, and I think he patented the idea of the helical part of it,
mm-hmm.
and developed that. But I think then Howard Carey is the one that carried it further and produced the actual working models.
Mm-hmm.
And then this fella Test was hired, and he made a winding machine to wind the core.
Mm-hmm.
And it wound the core, put the fine wire over around the main core,
mm-hmm.
and it did it in such a way that it would measure the resistance so that it would vary the speed of the wire going through so that it would give you a linear winding. And then, of course, it had to brush the enamel off of the wire to make contact to it, and it would make measurements as it was going through the machine, so... Yeah, Tess was—he was a pretty smart guy. He's the one that started that method of winding these things and making them linear. So that this Charlie Donaldson—he was put in charge of the winding machine. So he did all that, and of course it wound the core and then coiled it in the spiral.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd cut them off into 10 turns and bring the wires out and then put them into the case for the helipod. And I used to do that mainly of assembling them over there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun.
And just staying in the, I guess, maybe we could stay a little bit in this period before the move in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
But once Dr. Beckman left Caltech and was working full-time at NTL. Could you describe his role, his day-to-day presence and in those days?
No, I can't really tell you too much about that because I was in the back end, he was in the front end. And the main contact I had was when he'd come back in the plant. And talk to the workers a little bit and then bring people back. That was the main thing that I had, except for one time when, after I was there for about, I was hired as a temporary thing. They had a splurge on the Model G pH meter, and so they needed additional help, so I was hired just to lace the cables for a while.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
So after, I don't know, maybe a month or so, he called me up in the office, you know, and he used to call me Willie at the time. That's what I went by. Hi, Willie. He says, well, he says, how did you like working here? how'd you like working here? Oh, boy. Yeah, I thought, nice. You know, all that. Well, he says, you've been doing a really good job. So he says, I'm going to give you $5 more a month. So I got a $5 raise. I guess from $65 up to $70 a month. But other than that, I didn't have a whole lot of contact then, except at Christmas time. We'd all get together and we'd, like, here's a picture. I guess this is about the second. It must have been about the second Christmas. 38, I'll be darned. It is the first one, huh? Okay. So, that was pretty good. And then we used to come out there and he'd play the piano.
And he kept you from going to the war.
Yeah, but not this time. That's quite a bit later. Yeah. So, what else on 3330?
Any other? Those were my questions. Did you have, what was your interaction like with Carrie? Or are there any words you want to say about the other folks who were working there at that time? Your impressions of them?
Well, let's see. Howard, of course, I felt did all the design work on the instruments. Baxter. Is his first name? Baxter. Anyway, the one that was in the glass shop, he designed the standard cell. At least that was my understanding, which is a pretty important one for the modern gene. But seeing as I was just a young kid, about what, 18 or 19 or something, I didn't really get in with the engineering group too much, so I really can't say much about that.
Mm-hmm.
All I remember is I thought he was a pretty smart guy. So, at least at the time that we were over in Pasadena, a little closer there in South Pasadena, and I worked with Howard a little more there.
Okay. And what was your sense of what business was like? You know, I guess you were just mentioning you were hired on because of a crunch and, I guess, needing orders for the Model G. Did that sort of crunch never end for the pH meters? Or
still has.
Yeah.
No, it. We kept getting more and more orders. And then more orders for the Model R, which was used in a lot of the manufacturing plants in the water industry. We had them out in the, I think out in Covina, and the water plants out there. And they used it to check the condition of the water. Had some of these down in holes down the ground and in various other places around for monitoring the water condition. And sugar manufacturers used them because they added acetic acid to the sugar to make it crystallize properly. And so they had to know what the pH was, how much acid to add. So they developed a flow meter, they call a flow electrode. So that the sugar would go through it and it would measure the stuff as it was going through. And then that went to a controller. We built a controller so that it would turn the valves on and off and put the right amount of acetic acid into the sugar.
So when was that you did that whole system? Is that before the move? Or?
Yeah, just before the move.
I didn't know that. So could you say a few words then about the move and what that entailed and what changes that brought about?
Well, I remember them building the place, and it was, what did he pay, $250,000 for the place? Some fabulous amount, I forget the time. And the move was fairly easy, except that when we got into the place, well, it was like a big warehouse. I mean, we had a few benches here and a few benches there, you know. There were not too many of us at the time in this pretty great big building, you know. And the whole bottom part of it was the machine shop. And then we had half a dozen pieces of equipment down here in this great big place, you know, like we thought we'd never fill it up. But then That didn't last too long. And we got that filled up and had to build another building on top of the, in the back end. So, man, let's see, what else here on the actual move? It didn't take us very long to move because we didn't have a whole lot to move.
Right.
But it went pretty smooth. We managed to set up a few benches and then got back into business in a very short time.
When did you first become aware of the effort to make a spectrophotometer? Is that closely following the move, or?
Well, let me think. I don't remember too much about the very start of it.
Mm-hmm.
Our group, at that particular time, I think I was working for this Frank Camarda. He was the supervisor of the, or the head of the group of the electronics section. And we made the electronics for the Spectro.
Did you send me an email?
Now, they had another department where they actually did the assembly of the Spectro. So that was not our particular mm-hmm. area. It was another complete group that made the spectrophotometer. So we made the electronics. Other people did the assembly of it and put the electronics in with it to make the final instrument. So I didn't get into the actual guts of it.
Mm-hmm. But when did that... were you involved in... Well, could you tell a little bit more about the story of the development of it? I mean, you came in once they already had designed the electronics, or was there some trial and error there?
Oh, I'm sure. The thing is that this all was taking place in the engineering department where they, developed it and did the work on it and got it in the final state before, of course, we went out. I remember this Russ Vanneman was the head of the... drafting section over there mm-hmm. in South Pasadena, and I remember all the drawings and so forth that they had for the Spectro, but actually getting into doing much with it, I didn't mm-hmm. get into that. I remember seeing it over there in the engineering group. You know, I used to go over there occasionally and see what's going on, but that's as much as I got into it.
Mm-hmm. Did the production was it pretty a rapid increase in production, or did you find yourself working on it a lot in fairly short order, or was it, did it take some time to build?
Well, I think it started off slowly, but then I'm pretty sure it did increase pretty rapidly. Yes, that Spectro, the DU mm-hmm. Spectro, seemed to become a pretty good seller, so it did increase pretty rapidly.
And was the... What was the electronics... Were the electronics in the DU very similar to the... electronics, the arrangement, the design, the components that you've been using, familiar with from the pH meter?
Yeah, that's great. Okay. It was pretty much the same circuit.
Yeah.
The vacuum tube voltmeter is really what it was.
Right.
And so it was quite similar. But the first one had the batteries inside of the mm-hmm. pH, inside of the Spectro on the bottom part of it, and of course the electronics were in there too. Used a photocell, and the photocell is another thing that they made there at the plant.
Mm.
Photocell, and they made the hydrogen lamp for it. And then we in the electronics section made the hydrogen lamp power supply for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I did have something to do with the layout and the making of the hydrogen lamp power supply. I did that, so, and the cable board and taught people how to lace cables and that sort of thing. But I can't tell you too much about the Spectra itself, you know, as to all the little details on it.
What was the responsibility for making the photo tube and the hydrogen lamp itself? Was that over in the glass shop?
Yeah, I think Dr. Baxter is the one that did that. Yeah, I think he had. He was the one that I think did all the design work on that. So what kind of products
you got right now? And yeah. he had joined NTL rather early, hadn't he?
He was there when I started.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it would have been 36 or 37.
Right. And what about Fracker? Henry Fracker?
Harry?
Oh, I can't remember the first name. He was another early person, I think, that helped facilitate Carrie joining the firm. Was he?
He wasn't there when I started.
Okay.
So I don't know. I've heard the name, but I don't remember the man.
And could you... Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, could you describe sort of how production worked in South Pasadena? That's really about the information about how the production worked is probably something I know the least about. You know, I know a little bit more about, at the earlier stage. But so the electronics group is, producing the electronics. The glass shop is producing, I guess, all sorts of tubes beyond the...
Yeah, of course, maybe all the electrodes.
Right.
And the photocells and the hydrogen lamp itself and the standard cells. And pretty much what the glass shop did.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, each group would made... their particular portion of it, and it all come together. The electronic portion would get the panels that were made in the machine shop, and all the other parts, that go along with it. The machine shop would make quite a few of the parts, and then we'd get all these things and assemble them, put them all together. Made the cables. Over in South Pasadena, I taught the people to lace cables. Because I got out of that, and I was doing the... Well, I actually, not too long after we moved, then I was moved into supervisor of the electronic section for the, mainly the Model R. Because that started to grow quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And also doing more work assembling the helipod. Because the helipod, of course, started to grow because I needed those for the service.
Right.
And so we were working 10, 12 hours a day making helipods. And then, of course, Model R's also. That was growing quite rapidly. So we made quite a few Model R's. And then I had about six people working for me in assembling the Model R. In fact, I can't remember now. We did the Model R and also the helipod. I'm trying to think of how that all fit together. And then we were working on them. Both of these things, because we would work 12 hours a day putting the helipods together, because they had such big requirement for that.
And one step back before getting into that story of the helipods, could you say some words about in the post-assembly production process, was there, I guess I'm interested in what sorts of quality assurance or quality control practices, National Technical Laboratories had, so how you tested the electronic systems coming out of, mm-hmm. of your section, what they did to test the tubes, and then at the end, once the instrument was assembled, was there testing then?
Oh, yeah. Could you? Yeah. Well, we had our own quality control. In fact, there was one time when, when was this? Probably in 1940. Dr. Beckman got a letter from somebody, some higher up, they shot back east. The fact that his pH meter stopped working, and they found an unsoldered connection. So we all were gathered together. Our boss got us together. you didn't make mistakes, you know. And you didn't really have a quality control group because, you don't make errors like that. So that's pretty much the way it worked there for quite a while. Mm. In fact, I don't remember having any kind of an inspection group up there in South Pasadena. Mm. I don't think there was one.
Very modern concept.
Yeah. So it was just one of those things where you did the job and you did it right the first time.
And was there a final test of the instruments before they were shipped?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they went through testing. Of course, they tested all the, standard cell. It had its own test. It ran for quite a while, and they had to run those for a number of, I think, weeks in order to make sure that they were right.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the lamps that they made, the photocells and the other units, they had all their individual tests, so they had everything set up that way. And on the electronics, well, of course, we had a couple of people who would do the final testing and run them through, make sure that they've met all the necessary requirements.
Where were you getting your electronic components, like your vacuum tubes? Were they? Did you get them from RCA or what?
The tubes.
I guess the question is, you weren't making them in the house, were you?
No, we didn't make the vacuum tubes for the units. Bought those, and then we tested those, and then we had to process them. We had to coat them with, let's see, what do we put on the top? A wax-type material on the top, and then Aquadag on the bottom portion of the tube for shielding.
Mm-hmm.
So they all went through their own individual test.
Could you speak to changes that the war brought about at National Technical Labs? You mentioned the tremendous demand for the helipods from radar, I guess.
Gosh, what a year. 1941? We started making the RXG, I think it was 1941. Okay, there was a need, I guess, for a micro ammeter. And my understanding was that MIT had worked for a couple of years on trying to produce an instrument for this purpose, for a radiation detector, and didn't have success. And Dr. Beckman was back there at one time and at some meeting, and he told him that, hey, we have something on the shelf that'll do the job. So he came back, and I guess he talked with Howard Carey about it, and they agreed that they could do this. So Howard gave me some circuits, modifications for our Model R that we had, the pH meter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went ahead and rebuilt the Model R and determined that it would work for that purpose. But there were a number of modifications that had to be made, and there was one thing probably that MIT had the biggest problem with, was the input tube. And the problem there was that the current, this was down to 1 microamp for a full-scale reading on the meter. And even without any input on there, you'd get a reading maybe half scale. And so you had to get it down to the point where it was almost zero, you know, to make it work properly for them. So Howard and I did a lot of research on that, and he finally came up with an idea of the fact that there was must be a voltage being generated someplace in the system that the instrument was measuring. So he told me to take the grid cap off, the cap off the tube. Mm-hmm. And we would paint an Aquadag around where the wire comes through the glass.
Paint it what?
Paint it with Aquadag.
Oh.
A carbon material. Just the very top of it, about less than a quarter of an inch around the top, because what he figured was that where the wire was coming through the glass, there was a difference in potential between the glass and the wire,
mm-hmm.
and it was creating a voltage. So by painting around here, this would short this out.
Mm.
And sure enough, I did this and made tests on it, and we were in business. Then we had to glue the caps back on again, so I made, seems like, thousands of tubes. Anyway, then I had to test each one of them, make sure they would work properly. But that was one of the bigger things, I think, that made this whole system work.
Hmm.
Well, that was the Model RXG, which later on I find out that was used to control reactors up in Hanford, Washington.
Right.
That actually would control the reactor and also the water that they'd let out, because when they extract the plutonium from uranium, of course the water was used for cooling,
right,
and then the water would become radioactive, so they'd have to leave it out and let it out in a pool for quite a mm-hmm. while before it was usable and could be put back into the river. And so they use these instruments also for checking that. So it was kind of an important instrument.
And this is taking place in the midst of a very large scale-up for just the production of the potentiometers themselves?
Yeah. In fact, that business got so big they had to spin that off into a separate group they called the Edipot Corporation.
Right.
So that was, it was a pretty good-sized operation.
And is that what quickly led to the filling up of the South Pasadena facility? Was the helipod activity war work in general?
No, I'd say that both pH meters and the spectrophotometers were the two mm-hmm. big things down there. And then the helipod, of course, was one that added to it and got to the point where it required more space, and they had to really increase the volume very quickly on the helipod. So that's why they, I think, started up the other complete separate mm-hmm. operation.
And what could you, and what about demand for things like, well, I guess you talked about the Model R, demand for the Model R pH meter went up during the war, similarly for the DU.
Yeah, the Model R during the war was used because they couldn't get rubber.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed to make synthetic rubber, and this Model R was a thing that was needed in order to produce synthetic rubber. So that meant that the volume on that went up quite a bit. So I can't remember how many we made per month, but I don't know, between 25 and 50 maybe a month, which at that time was pretty good production.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any thoughts about, I guess it was during this period that there was the development of infrared spectrophotometers, the IR-1 happened during the war?
Yeah, well, again, see, that's kind of a little out of my area.
You weren't involved with the electronics with that at all?
Well, I guess the IR-1 was something that was developed by Shell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then quickly after that, I guess we went into various other spectrophotometers of our own.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably the most important instrument that we made was that RXG for the Atomic Energy Commission up there at Hanford, Washington.
And do you recall when Arnold O. Beckman Inc. was established? Was there any interaction there between the?
No.
It's familiar to things.
It was probably late 40s, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably nobody that knows at this point. Do we know the employees of Arlo Beckman Inc.?
Well, wait a minute now. I think Bob, what is it that worked there?
Do you have a picture of Arlo Beckman Inc. employees?
We've got in the milestones the date that that.
We have the date. I forget the date.
And what their particular.
Go ahead. Right. No, that's why, Gene. That's we need.
Yeah.
And what their particular products were.
Well, they were the oxygen.
Didn't Bob Maraska start over there at?
No, I don't think so.
I think he's always been a spectator.
Somebody I've talked to just recently is the one that started over there in A.O. Beckman.
That's what we need to find that person.
Now, who? I thought it was.
I can give Bob a call.
I'm pretty sure he did.
I'll just go call him, and if he's home, he can say yes or no.
And if
he said yes, did you want to talk to him?
Well, now if he didn't start, maybe he knows who did.
Okay.
Arnold O. Beckman Inc. is sort of a clandestine operation because while it existed during the war, it wasn't incorporated until 1946.
Oh, really? That late?
They were making something special for the war.
Sure.
That's correct, and AOB had it all under his control, and unless we get somebody who was there and knew what went on, we're never going to find out.
Well, the products they were making.
Well, we know what they were making.
We know what they were.
Yes. But we don't know anything about the operation.
Initially, I think he organized it as a sole proprietorship.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. He was making a little.
Yeah, he was turned down by the board. That's his
right. Yeah, and he, of course, making a little oxygen deal, dumbbells. And well, I know, as I say, that somebody worked over there at A.O. Beckman. And, yeah. If it wasn't Bob Maraska, and you know, it might be that Bob worked at another location in the Spectro Group down there rather than AOB. Yeah, but there was somebody else I was talking with that did work down there at AOB.
And so you would have seen him here at the...
Yeah. So if I think of it or run across this individual, well, I'll have to let you know.
Corral him, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, what else?
just to return to those, the war years then. So could you describe your particular responsibility to get, you were dealing with, you were supervising the production of the Model R, you were involved with the RXG as well. Did the organization of NTL change to reflect the change in size, the growth in the number of products, did on the production side, or how was that accomplished or accommodated?
I don't think it changed, it just grew.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there was any real obvious changes that took place. So
it's more specialized, or adding people with specialized responsibilities.
See, I was working for this Frank Camarda, who was the supervisor of the electronic area,
mm-hmm.
and making the Model G and the Model R and some of the other pieces of electronic stuff, like things for the spectrophotometer. And then I was making the Model R kind of under him,
mm-hmm.
and but I was in actually a different area, a little by myself, with about 4 or 5 people, and we were just making this Model R. That's all we were doing,
mm-hmm.
Along with the helipod that we were putting together. So then I was decided that we'd move that into a separate section, this Model R. So then I was given that as a separate group, so I was put over that. So, kind of the way it grew.
And for how long was the Model R produced?
Oh boy. Yeah, it would have been from, had to start in 39, because it was over in Pasadena, we started that. And then it was, gosh, it was produced for quite a few years. My memory on years is not all that good.
So well into the, was it produced into the 1950s, do you think?
Did you produce it down here?
No. No.
That's okay, it's not.
I guess, probably early 50s,
mm-hmm.
be my guess.
And Pat alluded earlier to a story about Arnold Beckman keeping you working from getting you a deferment or something during the war, because I guess you must have been eligible for the draft.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I was in 1A and out of 1A a number of times, and I used to, my draft board was up in Altadena,
mm-hmm.
which is a number of miles north, and every 6 months or 3 months, maybe, I forget how long it was before we had to go up there, but I'd have to go to the draft board, and Beckman would go with me, and we'd sit down and talk to the guys, you know, and he couldn't tell them, of course, why it was necessary for me to stay there, mm-hmm. what I was working on, but he assured them that it was something that was necessary, and so I kept getting deferments,
mm.
and this went on for quite a while, and then I finally got a call to go down for examination, which I did in Los Angeles. And then one day I got a notice in the mail that said I was to appear for induction. And it said to tell my boss, you know, about it. So I got that on a Thursday. I went down to I went to my boss, which at that time was Claire Mason, and I told him, and I showed him a card. I got this saying that I was supposed to appear. He picked it up. He picked up the telephone and he called some general. I'm not too sure who it was, but it might have been this. It was pretty high up. I don't know if it was the Secretary of War or who, but anyway, he called somebody, and the guy says, "Tell him forget it. Just forget all about it." So I did. I never heard from him after that. So.
And that was because of both the importance of the. The RxG and the Helipot?
Or mainly the RxG.
Yeah.
Because by that time, I think the Helipot was starting to be spun off. Yeah, there was some general that came to the plant, and he got us all together, the whole plant, and they talked about the importance of the actually the Model R and the RxG to the war effort. But we didn't know for sure just what this was for. Never did know.
Hmm.
We didn't. We knew we were sending them to Hanford, Washington, but didn't know exactly how they were using it or what it was for. So the Tommy bomb was extremely well kept secret. Now I guess Dr. Beckman must have known. I would assume, but boy, not too many others.
Hmm.
So it was pretty well kept.
So how did things change once the war came to a close, both in terms of your work and the firm?
Well, I don't remember it slowing down any, which you might have thought would happen, mm-hmm. but it kept on going, and we kept increasing our workload and expanding. And then, of course, had to build the building on the back of the one at 820 Mission Street. And built a two-story affair back there, three-story building. And but I don't remember the year.
How large had the company grown by the end of the war? You know, when you started, there were the 15 of you. There must have been. Increased considerably in a very short amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, well, let's see, that picture up there is one that was taken in 1940 Christmas party of, well, it was still National Tech, that was 1942.
Mm. Right.
So I see 40, by the time we moved over there to 1942, it had grown quite a little bit.
Mm.
So, and then 45, at the end of the war, well, there were, I don't know, 100, maybe 150 people, maybe even as many as 200.
And so when did Vanneman and Carey depart? Is that
maybe? Well, we were still in the front building up there. They hadn't built the one in the back, so. And I see Howard in that picture. So.
What year was that?
42.
Well, he had to have been there through the IR-1 and the IR-2 because he was the principal design on the IR-2. So that would have taken up to the 44-45 period.
I would guess that it was right about 45. That would be my guess, because he was in that building there, which was the front building. You know when we built the rear building up there? No idea that one. That would help, but and I don't remember.
So that was before Jerry.
Was it was that departure quite disruptive, or not so much for you?
Well, it wasn't disruptive for me at all.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see. Before he left, there was another fellow that was hired for engineering. Oh boy. Anyway, I'll probably think of his name, but he was the one that took over the engineering group when Howard left.
Mm-hmm.
And he was another sharp engineer, so he was able to carry on, and there wasn't too much disruption there. The only thing was that Russ Vanneman was the one that did the all the drawings and so forth, but there was a whole lot of things that he didn't have drawings for. It was all in his head.
Oh.
So that was a bit of a problem. And they had to struggle there to go back and try and recoup all the information from a lot of the material that they had built, you know.
And how did your work and your responsibilities develop in the post?
My particular ones?
Yeah.
Well, I was of course made supervisor, and I kept that job right along till the end, really. Well, I was my boss's assistant, John Spray. So John Spray was going to be my boss. So I took over whenever he was gone.
What was his title?
Production supervisor.
And your responsibilities were to which part of the production of what products were you responsible for?
Well, my group did all of the electronics for all of the instruments.
Mm.
And well, I had a day and night shift. One time I had about 140 people working for me. And I made the all the component boards before we had when I was spun off to Porterville. Oh, we did all that. We made all the LS instruments, the liquid scintillation radiation type instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And of course oxygen analyzers and just everything that came along. Almost all of the instruments we made, we did the electronics, and those that were were strictly electronic instruments, we did the complete assembly on them. Spectrophotometers was another group. We had a spectrophotometer section or department. So all those instruments were made in that particular area there.
And you held that position, you did that for until when?
1981.
Until
1981. Yeah, I moved to Irvine, you know, went down there and charge of the, up in Pasadena, I mean South, no, here in Fullerton.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing the nuclear instruments and most all of the other electronic instruments other than the spectrophotometer. Well, we made the electronics for the spectrophotometer. And then things got too big, so they spun off the boards, the component boards, making up to Porterville. They started the Porterville plant. So they started doing that work. Took all my equipment and everything else, and of course had a pretty big plant up there and making component boards. And also then Frank Camarda had another section where he built a lot of the sub-assemblies for various instruments. And then what else got spun off? I forget now, but anyway, all the making of most of all the other instruments, by the time we moved down to Irvine, all the instruments were spun off to, again, Frank Camarda, and then I took over and did the nuclear instruments down in Irvine. So I did all that, the assembly and the testing, complete package then of the liquid scintillation instruments.
And what period was that? Was that in the...
What did we do? 62 we moved down there to Irvine? Jerry?
Pardon?
We moved to Irvine in 62?
No, it was after that. Because I was here. 72?
Oh, at least... What? Oh, I guess so, yeah. We moved down here, and yeah, it had to be 70-something.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Because the problem was growth, and the clinical wasn't big enough to move out. We didn't move until the end of the 70s.
Okay.
So it had to be about 72. I mean, we can look it up.
Okay. Well, I wondered if you could say some words about... So you're supervising the production of electronics for instruments from the early 1950s into the 1970s. That's a pretty... Is that correct?
Yeah, before that.
Before... Into the 40s?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, that's an amazing time in electronics, because yeah. You're essentially going from, you are going from tubes, you know, to solid state.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering if you could share some thoughts about, you know, what that transition was like.
Yes, well... Okay, let's see. What was there was a different, of course, different way of assembling things, because we went from a lot of wiring where the people, mainly the girls, would do individual wiring harness, you know, hooking up the wires to the various components, to where you'd have the transistors and so forth on component boards. So it meant that there was very little actual wiring involved, mm-hmm. and it was just a matter of mainly connecting the boards to the potentiometers and the external parts, so that it didn't make quite a difference there in the wiring. So So that was the change there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still quite a bit of wiring that had to be done. You know, there was things that had to be hooked up from one place to another. So
right.
They still had to hook the connectors from the component boards to someplace. So this production grew. It meant that we didn't really decrease the number of people that were doing the wiring. You know, it kind of either stayed the same or kept going up a little bit. So it was quite a change, but people just learned to do something a little different.
notice a difference, though, in moving from the tubes to the transistors in terms of the reliability of the electronic components you're using in production?
Well,
were they less dicey than the vacuum tubes?
I think that they became more reliable, yeah. And longer life, less heat. That's one of the big things. Heat, of course, is the thing that does most of the damage.
And were you using components that were made by, I guess it was the Helipot division at that time? You know, because it wasn't part of Beckman Instruments was creating electronic components.
Well, yeah, of course, we did use the Helipot in most all the instruments.
Right.
Yeah, because it was designed originally for the Model G and the Model M.
Mm-hmm.
So it was continually used for most all the instruments, any place where you needed a varying voltage.
Right. But further than that, you know, wasn't that division also making transistors?
No, I don't think they made transistors.
Okay. Maybe they made different.
They made, what do they call it? Well, they had a group of resistors maybe in a small package. Can't even think of what they called those now, but they're integrated, kind of an integrated circuit,
mm-hmm.
but it was mainly just resistors, and I don't think they made any transistors.
Okay.
Pat, why did you run
three of them? Let's see.
By the way, after I was, when I was, I got, was into this nuclear stuff, making those instruments, and finally the fellow that was in charge of the spectrophotometer testing that group, they'd had a group just to test the spectrophotometers, the bigger ones. He wanted to go back to, what was it, production engineering, I think it was. So my boss decided that I would take over that group. So I left the nuclear section and went into, I then became in charge of the spectrophotometer testing. So we did all of that work. That's what I did when I left.
What was that like? Can you describe that?
Well, I can describe the fact that the department was in pretty bad shape when I took over, and I did make quite a number of changes there and got it back into the point where we could see what we were doing and get it running properly. So I was that was an interesting job, getting things back in shape.
What, it just suffered from inattention or something?
Well, instruments, customers would order instruments in a certain configuration, and they didn't know what the customer was going to order, so they would build instruments in various types, you know, and then store them, wait until a customer would order something like that. And that wasn't the way that I operated the other nuclear section, so I would get together, start off and get together with the sales group, and find out, now, what have we got ordered? What's the customer want? And so we'd sit down and make a list of what was required there. And then I'd make up a list of all the different portions of, well, the different kinds of instruments that they wanted. And I'd check and find out what was already made. I had my office girl, I went through and found out what was already made, made a complete list of that, found out what we could use for shipping without building new ones, because there were maybe 100 instruments we're sitting around on skids, you know. So we finally got that thinned down, and I made some other reports and things that were used by the groups that made the instruments originally, tell them what style instrument to make, and then to us and into inspection. And it was they started to run pretty smooth after that. It worked out all right. I did about the same thing with the nuclear thing.
Yeah, I was just about to ask if
your
thoughts about
that. It was pretty much the
that.
Same sort of thing. That was something that required this. The way I got this, supervisors went to a... well, we had meetings where we'd go out to different plants. We went down to the... automobile manufacturing plant in one of the places in Los Angeles, and I noticed that everything was flowing together. The frames were picked up and put on the line, and the motors would come and sit in here, and then the bodies would come down, and everything, the wheels, it all meshed. Hey, why can't I do that with the instruments? So that's what I did there. We had certain things that we had to build, a kind of box for the component boards where they'd slide in. They had to be made a certain way for particular instruments. So I'd make up a list and give that to the people who were making the, assembling these boxes. And other people are making different portions of the instruments. So I had maybe six, eight different lists that I would spread out to my people, and they would make them in that order so that they would all come together and work out real well. So it made things run pretty smooth.
With that, so that's a quick run through of your career. What I wanted to talk to you, what I wanted to know about were more of your general reflections and looking back on that career, the change of the firm over time, the change of the industry maybe more broadly, and just your thoughts about the changes in electronics, the changes in the instruments.
Yeah. Well, of course, things really changed when the transistor came about, and it was a learning curve. I had to get to school and learn a little bit about transistors. Of course, I've been in electronic stuff all my life. That's the thing I was interested in, so I would play with that at home.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's probably one of the reasons why I didn't advance in the company all that far, because those that going up the ladder, I can see that they're spending most of their time there at the plant and going out with their bosses, playing golf and so forth. And,
right.
And I wanted to get home and work in my shop on electronics. So that's probably one of the reasons why I didn't go up too far. So I was happy with what I was doing. But going into the transistors, of course, that did change everything, and things became smaller. And more reliable, and it was probably the biggest change that took place. So, I don't know what else I might mention as far as the company is concerned.
You really saw it go from a very small operation to an extremely big one.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts about that, or,
Yeah, of course, I didn't, I wasn't in a position where I, was either affected by the changes too much, or I didn't see all this change. So, I kind of, into the business of doing the assembly and all that kind of stuff, so I didn't get into it. Seeing as many changes as I might.
Mm.
There were changes in my boss's bosses, some of which were not to my particularly liking, but anyway, it all worked out.
Great. And
Jerry was never my boss. Her boss's boss.
Well, thank you very much, Will. That covers the questions Will.
I probably wasn't able to add as much as some might that might have been in a little different areas at various times. But
did you talk to him about Howard Carey, the person, and what his impression?
No, I didn't. Other than that, he was extremely smart and actually was, a realizer of certain things. But that is an excellent question.
He could. I think he could visualize how things are going, and he was one of the nicer kind of guys. He wasn't snooty or anything of that sort. He was just a real nice guy. But
did he have the reputation of being honest, credible? How was he thought of by?
Yeah, as far as I know, he was considered to be honest and, of course, very intelligent. Yeah. So, more than that, I don't know.
Well, there's quite a controversy between what Dr. Beckman believes happened and what others believe happened, why Carey left. And this particular article in the Times, which you may recall, says one of Beckman's few business mistakes came early among his top engineers in the late 30s was Howard Carey, who helped Beckman design the Model GE spectrophotometer, a device that revolutionized laboratory testing by allowing researchers to analyze chemical compounds in seconds. It was a big moneymaker for Beckman, but Carey thought he could redesign it and make it better.
Mm-hmm.
Arnold said, why, recalls 60-year-old Peter I. Lippman, a patent attorney in Montrose, who we have to look up, who later worked for Carey. Carey and a handful of other engineers interpreted Beckman's decision as choosing profit over science. That was the beginning of the end, as far as Howard was concerned. He took off and started his own company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's pretty much the way that I understood it.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, and also I think Howard and Dr. Beckman disagreed somewhat on wages. I know during the war wages were frozen, but Howard thought that there was a way around that, and he could get should be paying some of us a little bit more money. But I guess Dr. Beckman didn't agree with that, so it was another one of the contentions there.
Right, wages were frozen during the war.
Yeah, but I guess there were ways around increasing the wages somewhat.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Pat.
So, I guess Dr. Beckman was, you know, he had it set one way, and that's the way it was going to stay.
Right. Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much. We'll, maybe we'll switch this off for a minute and...